Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, published Saturday, July 2nd, 2022. Front page. Proposed Railroad Commission rules draw criticism, by Mella McEwen. Following legislative mandates in the aftermath of last year's winter storm, the Railroad Commission this week unveiled a new weatherization rule designed to address weather emergencies that occur any time of year. The commission is hosting a workshop on the proposed rule in Austin on Tuesday and will be taking public comment on the rule through August 15th. A final rule is expected to be adopted by the end of the summer. The rule covers critical facilities that are listed on the state's electricity supply chain map at the time of rule adoption, as well as subsequent versions of the map. Facilities covered include natural gas wells and oil leases producing casing head gas, underground storage facilities, and gas processing plants. Gas pipelines that are also on the map and directly serve electric generation also fall under the rule. The Permian Basin Petroleum Association has been working with the Railroad Commission to implement efforts required by the Texas legislature in order to share our members' concerns as well as ensure the focus remains on reliable electricity for Texans, Ben Shepard, PBPA president, told the Reporter Telegram by email. There is no question there is an abundant supply of natural gas produced in Texas, and our members are proud to produce this global commodity, which has enhanced the quality of life the world over. But, he continued, no amount of production can address power generators that won't purchase this reliable source of energy, and we must continue to review the electric market to ensure mechanisms are in place for utilities to serve Texans as they are required to under state law. Provisions of the rule include, but are not limited to, the following requirements. Implement weather emergency preparation measures intended to ensure sustained operations during a weather emergency that can put the state's electricity grid operation at risk. Correct known weather-related forced stoppages that may have occurred prior to December 1, 2022. Contact the Railroad Commission if a facility sustains a weather-related forced stoppage during a weather emergency. The rule covers a large group of types of facilities and infrastructure across regions of the state with different weather patterns and geography. Operators will be required to weatherize facilities using weatherization methods applicable to the facility based on the type of facility, the facility's critical components, the facility's location, and weather data for the facility's county or counties. The rule includes a table with extreme low and high temps for each county in the state, compiled by the state climatologist. The focus on natural gas is drawing pushback from some operators. Jeff Sparks, chief operating officer of Discovery Operating, called the proposed rule prejudicial. If gas is part of the grid, Sparks explained to the Reporter Telegram in a telephone interview, what sort of emergency operating procedure is required of solar panels, of wind turbines? Natural gas, he continued, did not cause the problem seen during Winter Storm Uri last February. He also criticized the rules applying to wells with production as low as 15 MCF a day, which he said are barely economic, let alone part of the critical infrastructure. That's not part of what the legislature intended. Said Sparks, I haven't found anyone who understands how this helps or what's wanted in the plan. If you're going to do something effective with critical infrastructure, figure out that 15 MCF wells are not critical infrastructure and figure out why all energy supplied to the grid isn't covered. Private school arrests, top list of 22 stories. Horrific bus crash near Andrews and county leaders voted out also make top stories list, by Stuart Doreen. In February, two of the prominent private schools in Midland were forced to deal with arrests of top officials related to the alleged failure to report with intent to conceal neglect or abuse. In mid-February, five administrators at Midland Christian, including its superintendent and top brass at the high school and inside the athletic department, were arrested. Weeks later, Midland Police Department officers arrested four Trinity School of Midland officials, including its head of school and top brass in the middle and upper schools. The aftermath included school officials stated that those arrested would not return to their respective campuses until the legal process is finished. But as it turned out, that was the beginning. A Midland County grand jury no-billed or opted to not indict the Midland Christian officials. Still, football coach, athletic director Greg McClendon resigned, as did MCS superintendent Jared Lee. There has not been a decision from the grand jury regarding the arrest of Trinity's four employees. There are no reports of whether any of the four have left Trinity. The aftermath also included scrutiny on law enforcement and the district attorney's office. Following the decision by the grand jury to not indict MCS officials, Midland Mayor Patrick Payton made a late-night statement in May expressing his belief in the men and women in blue and our legal and justice system right here in Midland. That doesn't mean we won't continue evaluating and taking a good hard look at why we did what we did, how we can improve and get better as we seek to serve and protect this community. Later that week, the Midland Municipal Police Officers Association took the unusual step of expressing its serious concerns about the grand jury process as it was handled by the Midland County District Attorney's Office in this case. Tragedy on West Texas roads. On March 15th, one of the great tragedies on the West Texas roads took place when a pickup collided with a van carrying members of the University of Southwest golf teams in Andrews County. Nine people died. The National Transportation Safety Board came to the region to investigate, and a region was reminded how dangerous the travel that many take for granted can be. The NTSB reported that a 13-year-old boy was behind the wheel of the Dodge truck that hit the van after a spare tire failed. The accident took place on Farm to Market Road 1788, a half mile north of State Highway 115, east of the city of Andrews. The University of Southwest golf teams were traveling back to Hobbs, New Mexico, from a tournament in Midland when the collision took place at 8:17 p.m. The NTSB reported that the 11-person passenger van was towing an 8-foot cargo trailer. Wilson seeks ousting of Midland DA. In June, David Wilson filed a petition to remove Midland County District Attorney Laura Nodolf. Wilson had been tried in December for the shooting of a Midland police officer and found not guilty by a Midland jury. In a petition for removal, Wilson asked for an immediate trial setting and also asked the court to temporarily remove Nodolf until a resolution in the matter takes place. The petition stated Nodolf searched David Wilson's home without a warrant, lied to a grand jury to secure Wilson's indictment, and abused the grand jury process in her quest to win. Judge Kelly Moore of Lubbock refused to order a citation to remove Nodolf, thereby ending the action against Midland's top prosecutor. County leaders voted out. The anti-incumbent wave rolled over Midland in March and May as County Commissioners Robin Donnelly and Randy Prude lost bids to become Republican nominees for their respective seats. In March, Jeff Summers collected 64% of the vote to defeat Donnelly and win the nomination for Precinct 2. Diane Anderson needed a runoff to knock off Prude in Precinct 4, but collected 66.4% of the vote in her head-to-head matchup with Prude. Cudd avoids jail. On March 23rd, former Midland mayoral candidate and business owner Jenny Cudd was sentenced to 2 months of probation and a $5,000 fine for her role in the riots at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. It was reported that the Department of Justice had sought a sentence of 75 days in jail. Cudd wrote the following in a statement after the sentencing. "I recognize that some of the language I used following my involvement in the incident on January 6th of last year may have caused division and confusion. While I do not regret traveling to Washington, D.C. to express my rights as an American citizen, to protest actions I don't agree with, and show elected officials that I expect my grievances to be heard, I do regret both unlawfully entering the Capitol and posting on social media about the incident without fully understanding the gravity of the situation and how it was perceived. While I cannot go back and change the past, I should have stayed within legal boundaries while calling for change, taken the time to understand the gravity of the situation, and tempered my emotions before making public statements. I apologize that the choices I made in the heat of the situation brought negative attention to our community in Midland. I have enjoyed all of my time in Midland for the last 14 years, and I will continue to be actively involved in our community in a positive way. COVID releases its grip on area. 2022 started with a spike in cases, 3,124, from January 9th to 15th. Deaths, 4 involving patients at Midland Memorial in January, and positivity rates, more than 50% in January. By early February, weekly cases dropped to around 1/10 of the early January total, and deaths in February fell to 26. February, as it turned out, was the end of a 7-month COVID spike with 200 deaths involving inpatients at Midland Memorial Hospital going back to August. At that point, cases and positivity rates plummeted to the point where the percentage of occupancy of COVID patients at Midland Memorial has been in the low single digits since mid-March. On June 30th, Midland Health reported 8 COVID inpatients. Drought conditions. In June, the National Weather Service reported 1.72 inches of rain, a virtual monsoon, in Midland. It was more than the previous 10 months combined. During the first half of 2022, commissioners passed multiple burn bans. The U.S. Drought Monitor showed the region moving between extreme drought and exceptional drought, and rainfall totals have stayed inches behind normal from the start of September, minus 9.91 inches, and the start of 2022, minus 3.84 inches. Other highlights. A broken water main downtown dumped inches of water into the Bush Convention Center, flooding the facility and causing the closure that continues through the first half of the year. City officials have said insurance will help cover any damages that happen because of the flooding. There has been no public announcement about when the center might reopen and no details available on what caused the water main to break. Kevin Sparks breezed to the Republican nomination of the District 31 Texas Senate race. Sparks dominated a 4-person GOP race and avoided a runoff. With the lack of a Democratic Party candidate, Sparks is guaranteed to claim the seat being vacated by Kel Seliger, a Republican from Amarillo. From the sports page, Legacy senior pitcher Chase Shores drew a ton of attention from MLB scouts and led the Rebels to second-place finish in District 26A and a surprise appearance in the third round of the Class 6A playoffs. Midland College sophomore golfer and Monahan native J.T. Pittman won the NJCAA National Medalist title and led the Chaparrals to their third straight third-place finish at the national tournament. Midland College hired former successful Odessa College coach Trey Arnold as the new head coach of the men's basketball program after Pat Rafferty resigned following 5 years at the helm. Bryce Hoppel won the USATF Outdoor 800 title to qualify for the World 800-meter team. He also won the 800 at the USA Track and Field Indoor Championships and placed third in the 800 at the World Athletics Indoor Championships. Midland Classical Baseball won its second straight TAPS 4A state title. Cahoma Softball reached Class 3A state championship, first state tournament appearance since 2008. Shrimp Boil to Benefit Military Wives by Melanie Nicholas. The second annual Stars, Stripes, and Shrimp fundraiser will be from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. July 11th at Tall City Brewing Company. The event benefits Real Wives, the Midland organization that provides rest and connection weekends for the wives of injured combat veterans. This year's guest speaker is Real Wives alum and U.S. Marine wife, Caitlin Van Steele. Caitlin, 39, said she is looking forward to the night and sharing her story of love, brokenness, and healing with the community. Caitlin said her love story begins like the stories of many young military couples. She was smitten after meeting the dashing young soldier, Russ Van Steele, 16 years ago. We met right before his last deployment, and I fell in love with this goofy, funny, very extroverted life of the party person, she said. Russ had already survived two extremely tough deployments to Baghdad and Fallujah. He deployed to the Middle East again in 2006, and after he was discharged, they wed. It was like this fairy tale romance, she said. But then, as I like to say, we suddenly had this third partner in our marriage, his PTSD. The couple tried to hold it all together. They came to Midland for work. She was teaching school, and he eventually went to work for the Midland Fire Department. Russ loved his job and was even named Rookie of the Year. But after 3 years at the fire department, our world just sort of imploded. His mental health just got worse and worse. He struggled with the medic part of his job because it was very triggering for him. So was the heat and the desert climate. It was just not a viable situation. In addition to his PTSD, Russ had sustained a brain injury during his years of service, as well as permanent hearing loss. And so began their decade-long battle with the doctors and the Veterans Administration to get his disability rating. It was just a big, long battle with doctors, with paperwork, and with grief. Caitlin said there were times when they felt full of guilt and shame. But the couple refused to give up on each other or their family. They relocated to Washington with their twin daughters and have been working on rebuilding their lives. Though Russ has been out of the service for years, she said, he'll never be done. We have had to fight and claw for every bit of peace and happiness that we have. There is such honor and dignity in that, that we didn't give up. What a lot of people, most civilians, don't understand is the war is not over for my family. I fight, he fights. Our children have to fight that war every day. And that fight is exhausting. In 2019, Russ had the opportunity to attend a men's fishing retreat with the Real Thanks organization. The group focuses on helping injured combat veterans get back to nature, spending time with other veterans, and getting a chance to focus on the things they still can do, not what they can't do anymore. The kindness and compassion he was shown during Real Thanks was amazing, and he came back and wanted me to participate in their sister organization, Real Wives. Longtime volunteer Tanya Mansfield Loftus described Real Wives as a kind of a women's ministry. We bring these women here to Midland for a retreat, but we are also creating support and friendship networks for them to meet women in similar circumstances, she said. Since the program's inception, more than 100 wives have attended a Real Wives program. The weekend includes sports shooting, shopping, a Christmas-themed evening where the wives are gifted new pajamas, a nice dinner, and lots of pampering. Our soldiers are coming home with traumatic brain injuries, TBI, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other major injuries, she added. They come home as different people. Some will never work again. These wives have been home, often with their children, with no family or support systems to help them. They tell us stories of feeling very isolated and alone. These weekends are very important because they are meeting other women in the same caretaker situation. They learn that they aren't alone and that someone understands. Caitlin said that deciding to attend a Real Wives weekend was difficult. It was after the COVID shutdowns and restrictions and the world changed. It was really hard to come after being so isolated. I was very apprehensive because you don't know what you don't know. I'm the glue. I have to keep it all together for everybody. Taking a weekend away just felt foreign to me, she recalled. But the experience was transformative. To have other people pouring into me, not me pouring into them, made me feel grateful and humble to have the opportunity. I don't think people realize how much we do for the people we care for and how little we do for ourselves. At the end of the day, it was just a blessing to be able to receive. It was just everything. I am a wife and a mom and a caregiver, and I just try to be all things to all the people. It was nice to be Caitlin for the weekend and not worry about anything else. Since returning home, Caitlin said both she and Russ have found renewed purpose in mentoring other veterans and their spouses and helping facilitate other care groups. Our story is also a story of redemption and restoration and healing and love. At the end of the day, Russ is my person, and he is always going to be my person. Our faith is a big part of our journey, too. God just did a big work on Russ's heart. For me, our faith and not giving up is really intertwined. Stars, Stripes, and Shrimp is the biggest shrimp boil of the summer. In addition to dinner, there will be a live and a silent auction, plus live music provided by singer-guitarist Donnie Diaz. Tickets are $50 and include dinner, dessert, and two drinks. To purchase tickets, visit Real Wives, R-E-E-L, wives.org/events, and click on the Eventbrite link. Obituaries, published Saturday, July 2nd, from the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Georgia Hamblin Reeves. Georgia Hamblin Reeves, age 92, passed away peacefully on June 25th in Roseville, California, after suffering a stroke. She is preceded in death by her husband, Richard Reeves, as well as her parents and siblings, and is survived by multiple nephews and nieces, as well as grand and great-grandnephews and nieces across the country. Per her request, there will be no services, and her ashes will be spread at the base of a tree planted in her honor. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in her name to the Eye to Eye Project at i2inational.org. Geneva Fender. Geneva Fender, affectionately known as Gigi by her family, friends, and so many that she ministered to, went to be with her faithful, loving Savior at her beloved home in Ruidoso, New Mexico, overlooking the Sierra Blanca Mountain on June 29, 2022. Geneva was born in 1939 to Wyatt and Winnie Givens of Crum, Texas. Geneva is survived by her husband and love of her life, Dan Fender of Ruidoso, New Mexico. Siblings, Wendell Givens and Marilyn Gwen Johnson. Five children and their spouses, Kevin and Krista Fender of Abilene, Byron and Carla Fender of Midland, Paula and Doug Reynolds of Ruidoso, New Mexico, Carrie and Lisa Fender of Midland, and Barry and Lisa Fender of Midland. 15 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. A celebration of life is to be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, the family asks memorial gifts be made to support the New Mexico Christian Children's Home in Portales, New Mexico, 1356 NM 236 Portales, New Mexico, 88130, or the Foster's Home for Children in Stephenville, Texas, 1779 North Graham Street, Stephenville, Texas, 76401. Or the Dan and Geneva Fender Family Endowment at Tarleton State University, Box T-0415, Stephenville, Texas, 76401. Guadalupe Urias Gonzalez. Guadalupe Urias Gonzalez, 85 years old, passed away in Midland on June 29th, was born and raised in El Mulato, Chihuahua. She is survived by her son, Antonio Gonzalez, daughter, Sylvia Gonzalez, brother, Cruz Urias, and sister, Emadina Aguilar Urias. Five grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her loving husband, Pablo Gonzalez, mother, Eleuteria Marquez, father Refugio Urias Chavez, brothers Refugio Urias Jr. and Ricardo Urias, sister Elva Urias. Evening prayer service will be Tuesday, July 5th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Funeral services will be at Our Lady of Guadalupe on Wednesday, July 6th at 10 a.m. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Carrie Jo Randall, May 1st, 1961 to June 21st, 2022. Carrie Jo Randall, age 61, passed away in her home surrounded by loved ones on June 21st in Midland after a courageous battle with cancer. Carrie was born on May 1st, 1961 to the late Max Little and Edna Ruth Young in Blackfoot, Idaho. Carrie is survived by husband Douglas J. Randall Sr. and her sons Douglas J. Randall Jr., spouse Mandy Randall, Russell Little Randall, spouse Amanda Beeler, and Rodney Keith Davis Randall, spouse Stephen Davis Randall. Family and friends are invited to attend a celebration of life gathering on Saturday, July 9th, anytime between 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. at 2607 Ward Street, Midland, Texas. Death notices from Saturday. Dorothy Magruder. Dorothy Magruder, 92, of Midland, passed away June 29th. The family will receive guests from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Tuesday, July 5th, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m., Wednesday, July 6th, at Faith Temple Church of God in Christ, with interment following at Fairview Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home of Midland. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Guadalupe Urias Gonzalez. Guadalupe Urias Gonzalez, 85, of Midland, passed away Friday, June 29th. Viewing will be held Tuesday, July 5th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel, located at 405 North Terrell, Midland. A funeral service will be held Wednesday, July 6th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements were made with Heavenly Gate Funeral Home. John Miguel Marquez II. Juan Miguel Marquez II, 37, passed away June 26th in San Antonio. Visitation will be Thursday, June 30th from 6 to 8 p.m. with the rosary recited at 7 p.m. at Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be Friday, July 1st at 10 a.m. at Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Interment will follow at a later date. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Stanton Memorial Funeral Home. Online condolences can be received at www.stantonfh.com.
This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for July 2nd. Electric vehicles progress, but slowly. Texas is well down the road toward its conversion to electric vehicles, but the effort will be massive to put charging stations every 50 miles on interstate highways and every 70 miles on secondary roads and in the rural areas. Acting under the U.S. Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act that was signed into law last November, the Texas Department of Transportation has been awarded $60 million of the $407 million it will eventually get for the project. TxDOT must submit its five-year plan to the Federal Highway Administration by August 1. State Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican of Odessa, notes that all the charging stations will be installed and operated by private companies and that no state money is involved. Governor Abbott specifically directs TxDOT to include a way for Texans to easily get from Beaumont to El Paso and from Texline to Brownsville in an EV with a focus on rural placement and connectivity, Landgraf said. He requests that TxDOT lead in drafting the plan with input from impacted state agencies and stakeholders to ensure that every Texan has access to the infrastructure they need to change an EV. Landgraf said the expense will be split with 80% from the federal government and 20% from the state, with third parties funding the state's share. He said the project is being executed under the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program. More than 2,000 charging stations are already being operated in Texas, mostly in the big cities, by companies including Electrify America, ChargePoint, Ford, Blink, and Tesla, which has supercharger and destination stations. Most stations offer three levels of charging at multiple bays and fees varying according to which vehicle is used and for how long, with a goal of a maximum of 30 minutes to take on a full charge. TxDOT divisions have begun collaborating with the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality and the State Energy Conservation Office at the Texas Comptroller's Office to create the deployment plan, a TxDOT spokesman said. The plan will contain sections in areas such as charging infrastructure deployment, existing and future conditions, contracting, implementation, and program evaluation, as well as documentation of state agency coordination, stakeholder outreach, and public engagement. It will address statewide connectivity and initial EV charging placements needs to be reliably traveled across the state and in rural areas, as well as augmenting the needs in urban areas for greater densities of EV vehicles, the spokesman said. This is Jane reading for the Odessa American for July the 2nd. TxDOT cuts through white noise with campaigns. The Texas Department of Transportation spokesperson for the Odessa District said during a phone interview, it can be challenging to warn people of the dangers of drinking and driving. Jean Powell, the spokesperson for TxDOT's Odessa District, said the department tries to cut through the white noise with various campaigns throughout the year. TxDOT released its Faces of Drunk Driving campaign in June, and Powell said those warnings are amplified during an extended holiday weekend for the 4th of July. Powell said he doesn't want fun to turn into a funeral. We encourage people to make sure they are being as safe as they can be on the road. Some of the messaging can sound repetitive, but when you consider we had over 1,000 people killed in drinking and driving crashes, obviously the messages need to be repeated often. We are still seeing the same kinds of crashes that we've seen for decades. We aren't saying you can't go out and have a good time. We aren't saying you can't have adult beverages. We are asking that you responsibly and have someone who is sober available to drive you home. According to the most recent TxDOT campaign, over 1,000 people died in drunk driving-related collisions in 2021. That equates to 24% of all traffic deaths in Texas being caused by drunk driving. Powell broke those numbers down even further by talking specifically about the Odessa District. In 2021, Powell said there were 144 fatal collisions in the Odessa District, and 38 of those were drunk driving related. Powell said during last year's 4th of July, there were 11 drunk driving related collisions with one fatality. He said there's potential for that number to be higher this year with the extended holiday weekend. The biggest thing is to make people realize that it's personal responsibility that makes the difference. Our campaigns can be fun. They can be serious. They can be dramatic. They can be melodramatic. Until a person gets behind the wheel and says, I'm going to do the right thing, messages don't fix anything. People's action is what fixes things. The TxDOT Faces of Drunk Driving campaign reminds us that the human toll of a drunk driving crash devastates the lives of survivors forever. Drinking and driving can have serious physical, emotional, and financial consequences that can last for years. A DWI or DUI can be expensive and lead to legal hassles, difficulty finding or keeping a job, loss of trust from loved ones, and regret. The Faces of Drunk Driving campaign will feature events around the state to share stories of Texans who deal with the consequences of a drunk driving crash every day of their lives. Events will include an exhibit of powerful video testimonials. Full video stories and other impaired driving information can be found at soberrides.org. The newest campaign from TxDOT is an important piece of the larger Drive Sober No Regrets campaign. It is a key component of the hashtag End the Streak Text, a broader social media and word-of-mouth effort that encourages drivers to make safer choices while behind the wheel, like wearing a seatbelt, driving the speed limit, never texting and driving, and never drinking and driving. November 7th, 2007 was the last deathless day on Texas highways. Hashtag End the Streak Text asks that all Texans commit to driving safely to help end the streak of daily deaths on Texas roads.
This article is entitled Author Historian: Flawed Fire Policies Hurt Pecos River Forecasts by Scott Weiland, the Santa Fe, New Mexican. It's become common knowledge that the decades-long practice of extinguishing natural fires made forests overly dense and more prone to big, destructive blazes. Now, a Midland author with a longtime affinity for the Pecos River region points to a portion of his 2016 book detailing how trees in this area grew thicker and larger, making the forest landscape more flammable, especially with the climate becoming warmer and drier. The wooded area that Patrick Darin describes in his book Bitter Waters, The Struggle of the Pecos River, is a microcosm of the West, where the federal policy of snuffing wildfires that naturally thinned forests led to overgrowth blamed for feeding increasingly common wildland infernos. Darin said the book relates directly to the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fire, the largest blaze in New Mexico's history, because part of the fire raged in the dense forest land near the Pecos River's headwaters. The two-month-long fire has burned nearly 342,000 acres and destroyed at least 300 homes. This was inevitable, Darin said in a phone interview. Sooner or later, it was going to happen, because the stage was set in the 1890s. Darin, 71, has authored more than two dozen books, both fiction and nonfiction, most of them with a Western theme. He said he has done voluminous research over the years on the history and ecology of the Pecos River, which stretches 926 miles across New Mexico and Texas. The federal government established the Pecos River Forest Reserve in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains in 1892. And within 6 years, it grew to 431,000 acres. The reserve would become a national forest in 1907 and then become part of the Santa Fe National Forest in 1915. In 1898, John D. Benedict, the forest superintendent, said a key mission was to protect the timber from destructive forest fires, Darin said. Benedict was among the forest officials promoting a no-fire policy that later would be more widely adopted. The U.S. Forest Service viewed quelling wildfires as its chief mission after the agency was created in 1905. The agency began carrying out that objective with greater zeal in the 1930s, with a policy of extinguishing new fires by 10 a.m. in the morning after they ignited. That policy would continue until the 1970s. Meanwhile, the timber on the Pecos lands grew much more dense through the 20th century as crews pounced on any new fire, Darin said, noting that foresters tallied the proliferating trees over the years. In a 1911 survey, they counted 50 to 60 ponderosa pines per acre, Darin said. By the end of the 20th century, the number had grown to 1,089 per acre, a 20-fold increase, he said. At the same time, they found 1,348 Douglas firs per acre by the late 1990s, Darin said. There are no records of how many of these fir trees populated the land in the early part of the century, but this is high density nonetheless, he said. When the area first became a reserve, a third of it was made up of old wildfire burns, and a third was open space, he said. So its natural state was space. That topography made it much less prone to mammoth fires, Dearin added. Officials estimated fuel loads went from 5 tons an acre in the early 1900s to as much as 60 tons by the late 90s, Dearin said. Aside from more crowded forests, hypervigilant fire protection led to tall trees towering over shorter trees, he said. This can create fuel ladders that enable a ground fire to climb up the shorter trees, then the taller ones, all the while intensifying as flames ignite their canopies into fast-spreading crown fires. Crown fires have been a common challenge in the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon blaze, which was driven by high winds and low humidity against the backdrop of drought. In the 19th century, the common view was timber should be protected from natural threats like fire to ensure maximum yields when logged. Dearin said, with the Pecos Reserve, the motives went beyond commercial extraction. Foresters believed increasing the tree cover would benefit the Pecos River, he said. In 1890, L. Bradford Prince, governor of the New Mexico Territory, called for the Pecos River's headwaters to be set aside as a park, contending that preserving the timber there was vital to irrigating the valley for farmers, Dearin said. They had all kinds of reasons why they thought the greater the timber, the greater the water flow would be, he said. It seemed to be well-intended, but not exactly accurate. A 1902 Forest Reserve manual reflects their views, Dearin said. They thought denser timber would create more shade, prolonging snowmelt, while shielding the snow against the wind, which causes it to dry and evaporate, he said. The trees also would keep the soil from washing away in heavy rains, Dearin said, citing the manual. That larger layer of soil could then absorb and store rain for drier periods, he said. But by preserving the timber, it denied nature its natural house cleaning, Dearin said. Before people got involved, low-intensity wildfires would burn through these forests, which were only moderately dense, every 5 to 25 years, consuming grasses and debris, he said. In the 1970s and 80s, forest officials resisted conducting prescribed burns and letting natural fires run their course, but began embracing this type of fire management in the 1990s, said Tom Reib, public lands advocate and author of a book that takes a critical look at the 2000 Cerro Grande fire. Both the Cerro Grande and Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fires resulted from prescribed burns gone wrong. Like other prescribed burns, the intent was to consume the fuels built up over the decades of agencies not allowing natural fires to thin them. The Hermit's Peak fire formed when afternoon gusts blew the burn out of control in early April. It later merged with the Calf Canyon fire, which ignited from a January pile burn that smoldered for months. Some similar missteps were made with both the Cerro Grande and Hermit's Peak fires, Reeb said. Crews felt pressed to complete the burns despite dry conditions and the risk of erratic spring winds, especially on sloping terrain, he said. Reeb said he can understand why agencies want to do as many controlled burns as possible, given how much the fuels have amassed. Though agencies have ramped up prescribed burns in the past 2 decades, they've barely dented the vast overgrown forests, he said. The budgets that they have and the personnel that they have, there's no way they're ever going to catch up with it, Reeb said. Federal agencies might have to make the hard decision of not doing prescribed burns in the spring, unless there's been an above-average wet winter, Reeb said. They have a smaller and smaller window to do the prescribed burns, he said, conducive for doing the much-needed burns, Reeb said. A recent study published in the journal Nature Climate Change says the West is experiencing the driest 22-year period since AD 800, putting the region in a mega-drought. Human-driven climate change is compounding the drought's severity and lengthening its duration, the researchers say, estimating it could drag on to the 30-year mark before it finally passes. Dearin said the changing climate combined with overgrown forests are a recipe for a catastrophic blaze like Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon, an unforeseen consequence of putting out all fires for most of a century. You take it being drier and hotter, and the density of the forest and fuel loads, and it was waiting to happen, Dearin said. This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, July 5th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, What to Expect in Second Half of 2022, by Stuart Doreen and Chris Haydorn, Midland Reporter Telegram. The second half of 2022 is underway, and the Reporter Telegram wanted you to be informed about the bigger stories and events coming. There will be elections, oil market news, and sports events to keep an eye on. Also, community leaders will have full control of the next tax bills, and diving will take center stage at COM Aquatics. Don't forget Celebration of the Arts later this month, a fly-in at Midland Air Park in August, and St. Anne's Family Fair in September. November candidate elections. There will be local elections in November for the city, school district, and college. Those on the ballot are Midland ISD, District 3, Tommy Bishop, District 5, John Trichetti, District 6, Rick Davis has indicated he will not run. Midland College, Place 1, Steve Kaiser, Place 2, Linda Cowden, and Place 3, Larry Lawrence, and City of Midland, Mayor Patrick Payton, District 3, Jack Ladd Jr., and District 4, Lori Blong. The sign-up period to put a name on the local ballots is July 25th to August 22nd. Tax election? That remains to be seen. The most likely candidate for a tax election in November is the county, but 2023 might be the better option, as time is running out to put an effective campaign together. Leaders have expressed interest in taking another shot at raising the sales tax in the county outside of Midland. The revenue could pay for expenses expected to come, like the cost of new or expanded jail facilities. Academic achievement improvements. The community is still waiting for a peek at STAR test scores, but internal metrics have Midland ISD officials optimistic that progress will be made. The first look is expected in July, and grades for individual campuses are expected in August. Budget season coming. Tax rates will be determined over the next few months for the fiscal 2022-23 year. The total combined tax rate for Midland ISD, the City of Midland, Midland County, Midland County Hospital District, and Midland College increased 2.1% this fiscal year to $1.742151 per $100 evaluation. The changes in the tax rates increased the average tax bill from $4,654.96 during the fiscal year 2020-21 to $5,029.55 for fiscal year 2021-22. The tax bill does not take into account any homesteads that a property owner may have or be eligible for. Colgate Energy, Centennial Resources to complete merger. Midland's Colgate Energy and Denver's Centennial Resource Development are expected to complete their merger later this year. When complete, it will create the largest pure-play exploration and production company in the Delaware Basin, an entity valued at $7 billion. When the acquisition is completed, the company will sport a new name, but remain headquartered in Midland with Colgate founders Will Hickey and James Walter serving as co-chief executive officers. Fly-in at Air Park. A unique event is being planned for Midland Air Park, A fly-in on August 27th is tentatively scheduled that officials hope will connect Midlanders with their executive air park in North Midland. From the sports page, Bryce Hoppel aims for a world championship. The Midland High grad will be seeking a world championship in the 800 meters when the World Athletics Outdoor Championships takes place July 15th to 24th in Eugene, Oregon. The Olympian already has medaled at a world championship meet this year when he placed third in the 800 at the World Athletics Indoor Championships in Belgrade, Serbia this past March. Hoppel finished fourth at the 2019 Outdoor Worlds only months after turning pro. Legacy grad Chase Shores looks to get drafted. Recent Legacy grad Chase Shores should be taken within the first five rounds when the Major League Baseball first-year player draft is held on July 17th to 19th. The 6'8" right-hander is currently ranked number 92 overall in Baseball America's draft prospect list that includes all eligible collegiate, JUCO, and high school prospects. Shores has another attractive secondary option should he opt not to turn pro, as he has signed to play baseball at LSU. LSU just recently lured Wes Johnson away from his job as Minnesota Twins pitching coach. Legacy football shoots for a fifth straight district title. The Rebels will be gunning for their fifth straight district title this fall. One reason why LSH has a good chance to do it is junior quarterback Marcos Davila, who has been receiving offers left and right this summer. Davila holds Power 5 offers from Baylor, Boston College, Indiana, Kansas, Pittsburgh, Rutgers, TCU, Texas Tech, and West Virginia. The big question is how the Rebels fare after losing 8 of their 11 starters on offense, including New Mexico State signee Macklin Young at running back and Tulane signee Christopher Brazel at wide receiver. Save the dates. Events. Celebration of the Arts 2022, July 15th to the 16th, Midland College. 20th Annual Centers Stage, August 12th, Petroleum Club. Midland County Fair, August 14th to 20th, Horseshoe. Midland Chamber of Commerce Annual Meeting, September 6th. Septemberfest, September 10th to 11th, Museum of the Southwest. Air Show, September 10th to the 11th, Midland International Airport. 74th St. Anne's Family Fair, September 22nd to 25th. Old Sorehead Trade Days, October 8th to 9th, Stanton. General Election, November 1st. State of Education Luncheon, November 16th. Midland Storytelling Festival, December 1st to 3rd. Sports. USA Junior Diving Nationals, July 25th to August 3rd, COM Aquatics. USA Diving U.S. Open, August 5th to 8th, COM Aquatics. Start of high school football season, August 25th to 27th. Midland High versus Legacy High football, October 28th. This article is entitled New Midlander Turns Knowledge of Design into Book Subjects by Iris Foster, Reporter Telegram. Home decorating has become a favorite pastime if the number of furniture and craft stores and social media networks like Pinterest are any indication. For the past 49 years, Midland newcomer Patricia Hart McMillan was at the forefront of several interior design trends through various positions, many in New York City. She has written 24 books on different aspects of the industry with her daughter Catherine K. McMillan as frequent co-author. Pat has compiled a mixture of books of high-end, think Hollywood penthouses and Hollywood Hills styles, landmark homes like Midland's George W. Bush Childhood Home, and three editions of Home Decorating for Dummies. The latter evolved when they lived in Florida and she saw a dummy's book at Delray Beach. She contacted the publisher, pitched a proposal, and developed text combining theory, Design 101, covering unbreakable rules, and practice. The first two editions have been translated into Russian and Chinese languages, she says. Over the years, she's worked with Schiffer and other publishers and top residential photographers, including Natalia King's son, who shot many of her featured homes in San Antonio. One of her favorite themes is Christmas, and she has published 8 coffee table books showing holiday decor in historic homes, including the governor's mansion in Arkansas, and designers' own Christmas decorations. Her subjects have ranged from the high rise to the high desert, and a ranch complex designed by Midland's Rotenberry Wellen architects is featured in one book, Contemporary Villas, which was co-written by her son-in-law. Pat's arrival in the New York interior design arena occurred after the mother of 4 went back to school and obtained a B.S. degree in English, SUNY, and a certificate in interior decorating from New York School of Interior Design in 1973. She combined those talents as interior decorating editor of 1001 Decorating Ideas, Christian Woman Magazine, and Home Mechanics, among others. She's also worked in advertising and public relations, but her first love was publishing hardcover books on a wide range of subjects, including residential architecture, design elements like glass blocks, and even a book on dogs, At Home with Dogs, which was a fundraiser for a San Antonio rescue organization. Most recently, she donated 7 of her Christmas-themed coffee table books to an auction which supported youth groups at Christ Church Anglican. Pretty good for someone who grew up on a farm in Missouri and rose from the cotton patch to the corner office. Along the way, Pat developed some Texas roots when she attended Abilene Christian University for a year. Also, her husband is originally from Denison, but worked in Tower 2 of the World Trade Center before retirement. After years in Florida, she, her husband, and daughter Lee wound up across the street from each other in San Antonio. A new romance for Lee with a Midland native brought the 4 to his hometown last September.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.